The most valuable book in the world, that would be the First Folio, the book that saved for the world the writings of William Shakespeare and some of his most treasured plays, Julius Caesar, Twelfth Night, Macbeth, The Tempest, and many others. Henry Folger, the man who became chairman of the board of Standard Oil of New York, had to have a copy. In fact, he sought to have all the copies that remained of the First Folio and just about anything else that told us about the work of one of the most consequential men of letters ever. And of course, that's William Shakespeare. Andrea Mace has written a book about Henry Folger's obsession called The Millionaire and the Bard, now out in paperback. Our conversation comes just a couple of weeks before the Kansas City Public Library opens an exhibit that will display one of Folger's first folios. Andrea Mace teaches economics at California State University at Long Beach. Like Henry Folger, she's a native New Yorker and has had a lifelong Shakespeare obsession. She spent much of her Manhattan girlhood in the New York Public Library listening to vinyl LP recordings of performances by the Royal Shakespeare Company. The Millionaire and the Bard is her first book. And Andrea, so nice to have you. Good morning.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
Well, wow. You know, what a story here. Why was Henry Folger so obsessed with obtaining these first folios, and what caught his attention?
Well, he had been interested in the plays and had read them in prep school and in college. But once he had a little bit of income and he was living in New York and sort of frequented the auction houses, he got the bug. And once he started collecting, he never stopped. And one never knows exactly what triggers an obsession. Part of it is maybe personality. But he bought his first copy very shortly after he graduated college. And it was not a first folio, but he bought a fourth folio, which was far much less valuable. And that was hammered down to him at $107. And he couldn't pay it all at once. He had to pay it over time, which began a lifelong tendency to essentially outspend whatever income he had. And he just continued that his entire collecting career for another 30 years. Now, most collectors of the era would have wanted a single excellent copy of the first folio. It was really a trophy fetish object. And the collectors of the Gilded Age would like to have had a really good, perfect, complete copy with the iconic engraving title page in it. And then they would have moved on to something else. But Henry Folger stuck with Shakespeare, and he expanded his collection over time to include not just books, not just first folios, but quartos and manuscripts and illusion works and sculpture and porcelain and on and on and on.
You know, as a Shakespeare fan yourself, to what extent can you relate?
Oh, I can relate to the why Shakespeare part. I don't have the collector gene. I live with my husband is a collector, and he has that gene of got to get the next copy. Oh, I have seven of these, but there's the eighth one is coming up to auction, and that's a little different. I don't have that. I have the admiration for Shakespeare. And I think the main reason for that is, well, there are two. One is the characters are just spectacular. Mm-hmm. And he creates, some of the characters are stolen. So as an example, one of the characters from one of Cervantes' plays is stolen. And he just makes it so much better. He makes that character so much better. I think starting out reading middle school, reading Romeo and Juliet, the girls can relate to Juliet. Oh, there's this guy and he shows up at a party. And at the beginning, he's in love with one girl. And at the end, he's in love with another. Don't you know a guy like that, you know, when you're a teenager? And then you get a little older and then maybe you relate a little better to Mistress Ford and Mistress Quickly, or you empathize with Catherine in Henry V. Or I think that's part of it, is just the characters are spectacular and very memorable. The second thing is, I think, and I read a little bit of Henry's correspondence with a Shakespeare scholar on this issue, is that if you read the plays and you get to know the characters, you realize that the man of 1585 or 1600 was not that different than modern man. And we see ourselves in those characters. And I think that was what really attracted Folger to the plays was you can learn about loyalty and friendship and jealousy and, you know, and marriage and on and on. And they're not that different than we are.
You know, for listeners, Andrea, who are unfamiliar with the First Folios, what are they exactly?
Sure. When Shakespeare died in 1616, only half of his plays had been published. And two of his friends, who were fellow shareholders in the Globe Theater, decided that as a memorial to their deceased friend, they would collect the rest of his plays, put them together, and publish them as a memorial volume. This was an extraordinary undertaking, in part because plays were really seen as ephemeral amusements and not highbrow literature. Poems, yes, the long-form poems, sonnets, yes, but plays, not really. They were really more like paperbacks.
And Shakespeare wasn't that big of a deal back in that day, right? I mean, nothing like he is today.
Nothing like he is today. He was really, he was certainly well known. He was very successful, both as a playwright and particularly as a businessman, as a shareholder in the Globe Theater. But he was not as well known as he is now. He was among, sort of first among equals. There were a lot of playwrights of the Jacobean era who were equally good, just not as well known as he was. And the major difference between him and, let's say, Christopher Marlowe and Ben Jonson and Lyly and Decker is that each of them really specialized in one area. So Marlowe wrote tremendous tragedies, a history. Jonson wrote tremendous comedies. Shakespeare did it all. Hmm. He did comedies, histories, tragedies, long-form poems, sonnets. He did it all, and he was superlative at all of them.
But still, he dies, and it's not like the world comes to a screeching halt.
Right. That's usually a surprise to people that there was not, you know, a national year of mourning when he died. He had retired 5 years earlier to Stratford-upon-Avon, a market town, and had kept his finger in the business by co-writing some plays with John Fletcher, who is his protege. But as I said, only half the plays that he had written had been published. They were not being performed that often anymore. The London audiences were very hungry for new plays. And his plays were, although there were still some being performed, they were just not as popular as they had been. And then we didn't know that at the time, but shortly there would be a civil war. The Puritans would take over the Parliament and forbid the performance of plays. And that would leave you a gap during the English Civil Wars where no plays were being performed. And, you know, people would kind of forget about what Shakespeare was. Had this book not been published, half the plays would have ended up on the ash heap of history. That's about the right average for the plays of the era from other playwrights. We know of about twice as many plays as we have copies of, and Shakespeare would have been spot on for that. Hmm. As it is, we have the 36 that were published in the First Folio, which puts us pretty close to 100%. We're missing two plays, but that's not bad.
So who were the folks who went out and sort of recovered these plays of Shakespeare's and included them in the First Folio?
They are the two greatest unsung heroes of English language literature, and their names are John Hemmings and Henry Condell. They were actors. If you saw Shakespeare in Love, one of them plays the chorus in the Romeo and Juliet, the stuttering chorus who comes out beginning of the play. And again, shareholders in the Globe Theater. So they would have had access at the Globe to whatever prompt books the company owned. And they would have been able to use those in part as a basis for the plays that they would put into the First Folios. They also had available to them the plays that had already previously been published in quarto form. And a quarto, difference between a quarto and a folio is essentially how many times you fold the paper. So if you had a giant piece of paper about 16 by 26 and you fold it once, you get a giant book called a folio. If you fold it an additional time, it's a half the size book and it's called a quarto. Well, many of the 19 of the plays had been published in quarto form. Some of them had been published more than once in not such good forms compared to with what we end up with in the first folio. They would have used those as sources. They would have used the prompt books that the company had and any manuscripts that they might have had lying around, they would have had access to. What Hemmings and Condell did that no one else could have done is that they, aside from having access to the manuscripts that were owned by their theater company, is that they had actually acted in those plays with Shakespeare under his directorship. So they would have known, for example, in one of the quarto editions of Hamlet that was published, they would have known, oh, no, that's not how it was. That's not how we did it. So they really were able to bring to the plays what we think is something much closer to what Shakespeare's intent was. Shakespeare had nothing to do with editing the plays that had been previously published. He had nothing to do with editing the plays in the first folio, but Hemmings and Condell were in a position where they could do that.
Well, clearly these two guys thought he was something special and his work was worth preserving.
Oh, absolutely.
What are these folios printed on, Andrea? Because that's interesting in and of itself.
Yes, they were printed on medium quality Normandy rag paper. So the sort of the center of the universe for the paper production in Europe was Normandy in France, and that was made out of essentially recycled rag, and that would have been made handmade into paper and then shipped to London to the area around St. Paul's Cathedral, which was like the, again, the ground zero for publishing in London would have been around St. Paul's, and the publisher would have purchased the paper from these French paper manufacturers. If you hold it in your hand, it feels much more substantial than paper that is made out of cellulose, what you would find the books printed on today. And one of the consequences of that is that it lasted a long time. It was not acidic and it lasted for a very long time. So that out of the approximately, we think, 750 copies of the first folio were printed in 1623, of them, an enormous number, 235, survive. And part of it is the quality of that paper.
Each of them is different. And why is that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a strange thought that if you had 750 copies, that they wouldn't be identical. And there's several reasons for that. So let me give you two reasons that that would have happened. One is that permission to print Troilus and Cressida did not come easily to Henry Condell and John Hemmings. In fact, they didn't get permission to add that to the first folio until they were already underway with the printing process. And one of the ways you can tell that is if you look at essentially the table of contents, Troilus and Cressida does not appear there, but the play appears in many copies of the first folio. So some copies had been printed and assembled without Troilus and Cressida, and others have it. So that's one big difference. And you wouldn't know that unless you had several copies to compare and say, well, wait a minute, it's not in the catalog. It doesn't say on the table of contents, but how come you have this play and I don't? So that's one of the things that you can tell when you have multiple copies in one place. You can compare them and see what the differences are. A second difference is an artifact of the way the printing process worked and the fact that paper was very expensive. And therefore, copies of pages that were printed that had mistakes on them were kept, and they were collated in with the rest of the pages into books. So here's what would happen for every page that was printed. Some copies were printed off. The printer would take a proof sheet, make corrections in hand on those proof sheets, hand them back to the copyright, the copy setter. This copy would be reset, and then the corrected pages would be run off the printing press. So there would be multiple copies of uncorrected pages, a single proof copy, and then corrected pages for each of the possible pages that was printed. So in random combinations of that, you would find, for example, you might pick up a copy and then, you know, some page in Cymbeline has got these proof marks on them. Well, those were the proof marks that were made by the printer. So every copy is slightly different. You might get a corrected page in Romeo and Juliet in one copy and an uncorrected page of Romeo and Juliet in another, and therefore they're all slightly different.
Andrea Mays is our guest. She's the author of the relatively new book, The Millionaire and the Bard. She'll be speaking about her book at 6:30 tomorrow evening. That's Tuesday at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the Central Branch, 14 West 10th Street. More information about that, kclibrary.org. I should just point out that UpToDate will be broadcasting live from the Missouri Valley Room of the Central Library on Wednesday, June 8th. That's the opening week of the exhibition of one of the first folios from the Folger Library Collection. That's 11 to noon next Wednesday on June 8th, talking more about these first folios. And again, Andrea's book is about William Shakespeare, his writings, and mainly about Henry Folger, the man who became chairman of the board of Standard Oil of New York, who had to have a copy of the first folio and every other copy of it as well. How many did he eventually acquire, Andrea?
He eventually acquired 82 copies.
82.
Which, 82. So imagine, so we think 750 copies were printed. Of those, 235 are known to survive. And he, in 1930, had acquired 82 copies.
So it's one of every three number. That's out there. That's just amazing. Yeah.
Right. That just for means of comparison, the next largest collection is 13, and that's owned by Meisei University in Japan. And then after that is five copies at the British Library. So it was, and then usually collectors only had one copy apiece. You know, J.P. Morgan, Henry Huntington had more than one, but the other collectors basically wanted one great copy and then, you know, that was enough. So just try to imagine over 30 years collecting 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way up to 82. It's a phenomenal collection.
Well, what struck me so interesting is he bought so many that he actually ran out of space at his house. And you wonder how often he would actually look at some of these incredibly rare books that he had acquired, because he stored them all away somewhere.
Right. He and his wife, who was also a Shakespeare aficionado, and
He talked her into being one, I think, to some extent.
Oh, yeah. But she was 100% on board, though. I mean, she was not just saying, oh, okay, Henry, buy another one. She was very much on board. She allowed, the collecting to intrude on their vacation every year. They would go to West Virginia to the spa, and they would bring along two giant pieces of furniture that included all the index cards that she had prepared of what was in their collection. Lest something would come up at auction while they were away on vacation, she could look it up and say, oh yes, we have a copy of this, or no, you should bid on that. So she was 100% on. I would not like that on my vacation, P.S. But she was 100% on board with that. They lived in a rented house in Brooklyn.
It was nothing fancy.
No, nothing fancy. I mean, in a nice neighborhood, you know, not a bad neighborhood, but not a mansion, a townhouse. And when the townhouse was filled to the brim, they would take their books and their objects down to the basement, wrap them in paper, put them into a crate, ship the crate off to a storage warehouse, one in Brooklyn and one in Manhattan. And I looked at two things. One is the checkbook stubs for the Folgers. Wow. And there are 30 years of bills for one room at one warehouse in Brooklyn. And then as that room filled up with crates, they would rent another room. And then as that room filled up, they would. So at the end, they had over 1,900 crates.
Oh my God.
Filled with books, objects, paintings, sculptures, and so on. And that's not including the things that were in the safe deposit box at the bank. But you brought up an interesting question. You know, how often did he look at these?
Of course.
One of the questions that I had was, well, when he was packing away these books and paintings and sculptures, was he putting the first folios in storage too? And the answer is yes.
Wow.
So when they would pack these things away, Emily would handwrite, eventually she typed, but handwrite an inventory of what was in each case. Okay, so this is case number 87, and here are the contents of case 87. And then Henry would go to, Folger would go to the warehouse, and he would make a little map in a brown notebook of what case was in which position in which room, so that, you know, in the event that he wanted to go find his Vincent copy of the first folio, he would know which room, which case, and he'd be able to sort it out. But he never did. So all those things that were packed away in their basement and put into those crates and shipped off to storage, he never saw them in his house again.
Oh, my gosh. Well, were these things protected from the event of fire?
Yes. Among the bills from the storage warehouses that I looked at, most of them said something like, you know, fireproof and burglar proof and alarmed. And they were all, sort of fireproof warehouses that he put these things into. Many, many copies of the folios have been destroyed by fire over time. And Henry was certainly aware of that problem.
Hmm. We should point out that toward the end of his life, he thought about a place to store his collection. Tell us about what he finally decided to do.
He and Emily decided they wanted to build a library and allow scholars access to the collection, and that this would be very valuable for scholars to be able to look at their copies of the first folio and at all the other things that they had. And they received letters frequently from people who said, oh, I hear you bought this unique copy of Titus Andronicus. Can I have a look at it, basically? And he would say, oh, I'm sorry, it's packed away in a crate, but I'm working on a library. And when that's up and running, you know, basically you can come and use the collection. They had an endowment. They saved their money. He was, again, an officer at Standard Oil Company, eventually chairman of the board. So he had a generous salary, but not generous compared with what he was able to acquire and how much he spent on the books. They had an endowment, and as it turned out, real estate was too expensive in New York City, haha. So they went instead to Washington, D.C., where Emily Folger had grown up, and they spotted a property across the street from the Library of Congress, and they thought, okay, well, this, we could afford this. Huh. We could build a beautiful library here. And it would be right near the Capitol building. The Supreme Court building had not yet been built, but that would also be part of the neighborhood there. So they engaged several real estate agents to quietly buy up the townhouses between 2nd and 3rd Street on East Capitol in Washington, D.C. And then there began the plan of building the Folger Shakespeare Memorial Library. And he and Emily were in on every detail of the design of the building. Originally, they thought they would have something that might have looked Tudor and on the outside. And the architect said, well, I don't know if that's going to fit in with the neighborhood. So they essentially built something classical with some deco touches. Mm-hmm. But as you walk inside the building, it looks like an Elizabethan hunting lodge. So, it's an extraordinary place. It really is. There are a couple of giant fireplaces that, you know, make it look like you would not be surprised to see Henry VIII there feasting.
Yeah, I mentioned that the Kansas City Public Library is putting one of Folger's first folios on display in a few weeks. How unusual of an occurrence is this?
Oh, extremely unusual.
Wow.
If you are not on one of the coasts, you're usually very far away from a copy of the first folio that you can see as a member of the public. So if you're on the coast, you can go to San Francisco or UCLA or Washington, D.C. or New York City and see copies on display. But if you're not, it's extremely difficult. Most of the copies that are in institutions are really not even accessible to the public. So in honor of the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death, the Folger Library is sending around a dozen and a half of its copies on tour so that each state will get a visit for a month of a copy of the first folio. Hmm. And Kansas City is one of the lucky locations that will have this on display. And I encourage everyone to go down and see this. Again, it's not that easy for members of the public to get a gander at one of these copies of the first folio, and you'll be able to see it. It'll be open to the to be or not to be soliloquy, and there'll be an exhibit about the first folio that accompanies the book.
Well, that's so interesting. Andrea May's new book, The Millionaire and the Bard, she speaks tomorrow evening at 6:30 at the Kansas City Public Library, the Central Branch, 14 West 10th Street. More information about that, go to kclibrary.org. And Andrea, you were just great. Thank you so much for taking some time. I sure appreciate it.
Steve, thank you for having me.
You bet.